This podcast is brought to you by the ILGA Oceania Rainbow Human Rights and Health Conference and PrideNZ.com.
Nō reira, kia ora tātou. First and foremost, it's my privilege to be able to thank those who have opened the door, set the scene and prepared the space for us today, beginning with that fantastic whakatau, the welcome from Mana Whenua last evening. And with today's opening proceedings and speakers. He mihi nui. I've had a chance to reflect on some of the messages that we heard last night, and they were profound. Renato, you talked about the need to continue to work on being together, taking strength from each other, and you warned about the consequences of fragmentation and isolation. Really, really important message. Jan, you gave voice to some of the realities of being together, and you spoke with humour and passion about those realities, and I think just about everybody in the room resonated with what you were talking about the challenges what we face being together and that we need to surpass, or that we need to meet. So these things together with that whakatau offered by Te Atiawa, the support of Te Whanawhana, made for, in my view, an inclusive and an uplifting beginning to our time together. So thank you all very much for last evening. And in fact, for the report backs this morning on the other meetings that have been held prior to us gathering today. This session is entitled Speaking Out Proud. It's a session where issues voiced by the LGBTI communities, the out communities, are listened to by a cross-party group of parliamentarians, and the session is being facilitated by the Human Rights Commission. Secondly, I'd like to acknowledge the arrival of you all to this open hearing on LGBTI human rights issues. Without all of you, this could not happen. Without submitters, it can't happen. Without an audience listening, it can't happen. And without our parliamentarians here, it's not going to happen. And particularly on behalf of all of us here, I'd like to offer our thanks to ILGA Oceania, ITANS and the conference organisers for allowing this session to take place in the context of a conference that is really, really important. I'd also like to acknowledge the expertise and the knowledge in the room here, not just here in the panel, but here amongst the people that are sitting here in the auditorium. I'm not going to pick out individuals by name, but you all bring something, you're all very special, and many of you have critical roles in our individual and in our collective lives. Thirdly, I'd like to offer our warmest greetings to our panellists. To my right, it's not Jan Logie. This is Kevin Haig from the Green Party of Aotearoa New Zealand. Please give him a bit of applause as an introduction. We have a New Zealand Human Rights Commissioner, Dr. Jackie Blue. Larissa Wall, New Zealand Labour Party. Dennis O'Rourke from New Zealand First Party. And David Seymour, ACT New Zealand. Thank you all very much for agreeing to be with us. We were disappointed that a National MP was unable to get leave from the House to attend our panel. However, we do understand the constraints that would have led to this decision. It's anticipated that the panellists present and the various government officials who received the report from today's session will be able to advise the government on the steps that are deemed critical to making that commitment a reality. The commitment that the government made after the UPR recommendations came back with no mention from the state parties making recommendations around human rights for sexual orientation and gender identity. At that point, the government made a statement that they were committed to an ongoing dialogue with LGBTI communities as part of their civil society engagement on the outcomes of the UPR. And so panellists and officials will be encouraged to continue to remind the government that that commitment is still there. Next, and but certainly not least, I'd like to thank those who have taken the time and the opportunity to make written submissions to the hearing process, those who are also prepared to make oral submissions a bit later on, and are going to speak to those just a little bit later on. So I'm not going to name those people, you'll see them as they come up, but please give them a round of applause. It also gives me great pleasure to acknowledge and introduce our team from the Human Rights Commission. Now, I'm not sure Cynthia was going to try and come down, but I haven't seen her come in, and no, she's not going to be able to be here. So our CEO and the Chief Commissioner send their regards. Chief Commissioner's just about to head off to Geneva and won't be able to come down, and the CEO's not going to make it. But we do have the leaders of the Sexual Orientation Gender Identity Portfolio within the staff team at the Commission, Dr. Jill Crisp up here, hiding in the back row, supervising from the park. And Wana Irueta here to my left. And thank you. And also this fabulous person that we've imported directly from Auckland for this morning, Sean Moody, our social media specialist.
Yay!
He will be twittering like mad. So can you tell us what hashtag we're doing these on, Sean?
Same one the conference one.
So he's tweeting to the conference hashtag the things that are going on in this session. So welcome, Sean, and it's great to have you down here as well. I have the honour of being the panel chairperson today. My name's Richard Tankersley. I'm a part-time commissioner with the Human Rights Commission. I'm based in Christchurch, and I have designation for the Sexual Orientation Gender Identity Portfolios within the Commission. I'm going to sit down about now, having done the welcome and introduction, but I'd like to now explain the presentation process. People that are going to submit will present to the panel their priority issues. Each slot, we've allocated 10 minutes to that slot for the presentation and any questions, and so when people are presenting, they'll have about 5 minutes to present to the panel, and then they'll be invited to answer questions from the panel. We'll give you a warning bell at 4 minutes. Now, you may not use all that time to speak, but it's we do want to make sure that the panellists get a chance to feedback or to check on some of the things that you're telling them. Panel members have had the opportunity to read the written submissions that have been given. And as I said before, in addition to the prepared submissions, there'll be some time for submissions to be made from on an oral basis. The time allocation for those will, of course, depend on our situation at the time. So if anyone knows at this stage that you'd like to speak, could you please make yourself known to Moana? So just pop down and have a quiet chat to him. We've already got you lined up. That's all good. You've got that logged. And we know that this is a panel of New Zealand, a New Zealand-based panel, and we're talking about human rights in New Zealand, but we have international guests here with great expertise, and it would be great to hear from you, regardless of whether you've come from Europe or from the Pacific, to offer some things in one of those speaking slots. And if we get to the point where we've still got some time, we might be able to have a bit of a general discussion. So social media, I think you've already talked about privacy, so if anyone has any concerns about their image being portrayed, then just have and have a yak to the organisers and or to Sean about those things. So let me just make the following points about how the panel will operate. Panel members are here to listen and to briefly question submitters as appropriate. They're not here to answer questions on political positions from submitters or from the audience, so that's not what we're doing. And of course, for this to work, everyone has to be respectful of the commentary made. You may not agree with absolutely everything, but this is a space where things can be spoken and heard and listened to, and that may mean quite a divergence of material coming out, and just be respectful of people and of the fact they've got something to say. As already noted, there may well be some government officials present who are also listening, and certainly there will be a report to relevant government departments to consider a bit later on, and the outcomes from the session will go to the conference organisers to be included as part of the conference. If any of that's unclear, please ask me questions as we go along. But for the meantime, it's Elizabeth. Where's Elizabeth? I've lost you. There you are. I thought I might pick on you to go first. Is that okay?
Sure.
Because you're fabulous. So first submitter. Oh, there we go. This is for
you.
This is for me. Oh. It means I can't cough without actually deafening the audience. Right, yeah, good. So our first submitter, Elizabeth Kittikitty.
Would you like me to come down
there? No, please come down. We'll have space for you, and if you fancy sitting while you talk rather than standing, we'll get you a chair. You're absolutely fine.
Another year down for Richard, while Elizabeth is going down, I just think one of the things we need to be really acknowledging of is the papa of the Human Rights Commission and those that have gone before us. Was there mentioned some of that?
Yep.
We also have Jack Byrne and Julia Watson here and Joy Littlecote. And
yes.
A seminal piece of work that Rosalind and Jack and Joy were involved in to be who I am, it's underpinned a lot of this work. And a lot of what you've got in front of you is part of that story. So,
yep.
Kia koko, ka kua, ngā mihi kia koko, ka kua. And it's with humility or humbleness. And I think we're trying to walk in the huge steps that you've left behind.
Mm.
So, kia koko, ngā mihi kia koko, ka kua.
Absolutely. Thank you, Joy.
Oh, kia ora koutou, ngā mihi koutou, ngā mihi mahana, kia koutou katoa. Particular shout out to Lisa. Oh, kia ora. Me te mata anua. Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aroha, kia koutou katoa. Particular shout out to Lisa, Kevin, and Jan, who I've worked with through our different community work. I just want to acknowledge how hard it is to maintain our activist and community ethics within a government and parliament environment, and that we really respect the work that you do on behalf of all of us. And kia ora to the rest of you. I expect to be getting to know you a lot better. The particular kaupapa I will be speaking on just very briefly, and I guess I should introduce myself, Elizabeth Kerekere. He mokopuna au o te taira awhiti. So I hail from Gisborne, but 20 years in Wellington. I am chair of Te Whana Whana Trust, who opened the hui today and opened the, was part of the, providing the tikanga for our conference. Part of what Te Whana Whana is about, our vision is Te Whana Whana ai he kahu kura I te rangi, a rainbow is forming in the sky. And our goal is for takatāpui to be able to tell our stories, build our communities, and leave a legacy. And so one of the major projects I want to talk about is a national rainbow strategy. I'm very conscious that for people in government and government agencies, when you're dealing with such a diverse community as ours is, and as takatāpui, we include all Māori who identify with diverse sexes, genders, and sexualities. So across the every spectrum, every new letter, every new identity, we cover it for those who are Māori. And so we are aware how difficult it is then for our government and Parliament to then say, oh, well, what are the key issues? Of the hundreds of issues, what are the main things? What is the next step? Our goal with the national strategy then is to coordinate those issues across the country, but it's what are we going to do about it? So all the laws that have been passed and all the changes that have happened in the last 30 years, I guess as Māori, we take a much, much longer view than that. We go much further back and we go much further forward. And so we're looking at what's the next piece of legislation that must happen for our community to progress? What are the next four things over the next 20 years? What are the key policies that have to change? Where does that sit in government? Who are the key people we need to be talking to? So that when we take all the issues our young people raise, when we take the issues that our intersex and trans whānau, our gender diverse people, our bisexual people, and all of us, because, and again, when you take the long view, things have changed, but those things our young people talked about, that was happening to lesbian and gay people not very long ago. Don't get me started on colonisation, how long it's been since we started the treaty, you know, since that all happened, and how much, so a lot is changing, and in some ways the big stuff, racism, still doing its thing. And so with a national rainbow strategy, it's something will be dedicated to over the next couple of years, so that we can work with government and institutions across the country to say these are the key things that we need to be getting on with next. This is, and I really want to emphasise that the strategy does not at all take away the power and the importance of each of us speaking on our own behalf and raising our own issues and speaking and engaging directly with government ourselves. But this is a way of coordinating effort and saying, right, and also even if some funding becomes available in different government departments, what are the priorities? What do we do next? What do we do in the next 5 years, the next 10, the next 20? So, nō reira, tēnā koutou, kia ora koutou katoa.
Kia ora. Panellists, do you have questions or reflections on what Elizabeth's had to say?
Kia ora, Elizabeth, and kia ora koutou. If this actually were a select committee, I would be looking for an opportunity to āwhi you and tautoko what you had to say. Certainly I like the idea of a national strategy. What I'm wondering about is what engagement you want from government or from the cross-parliamentary group in the development of that strategy. Do you want that engagement to occur while the strategy is being developed, or do you want that group or parliament to respond to the strategy once it is available?
I see that happening on a couple of different levels. One of them is that as it is being developed, there are going to be things that come up in your work already, and I suppose we would want to be able to help assist way, create a mechanism then for you accessing the community, making sure that you're hearing the right voices and as you continue with your work. And then something I guess we would want from you in the development of the strategy itself is a clarity of process. Mm-hmm. It's understanding who it is we need to go to for certain things. So if we're talking about changing the law, for example, around... And also that whole process from, yes, we can change the law and we can make rules at this level about how to treat transgender people in prison. How does that happen? What policies need to be changed across corrections, probation and police? What happens for the actual warden of each individual jail and prison? And then how does staff training roll out? So it's looking at, it's complex, I can't wait. For those who are strategy freaks like myself, it's very exciting. But it's that kind of level of engagement to say what is the process, depending on which level we're engaging with, because we have to be able to do all of it. Help.
Sure, Elizabeth. I just think we've got the government officials here in the audience, so I think a clear comment from you is that you would like government officials to go away with that request to have a rainbow strategy and the government to collaborate on that and at different levels. Is that correct?
Yes, I think it's very much going to be community-led. Yep. The way that we've structured it for Te Whanawhana, we're a very small trust. We work on the basis of community building, relationship building and collaboration, so we are not a funded organisation, and so that we're not constrained by funders' requests and constraints. And so in this, we're not necessarily at this stage looking for funding. That's not what this is about. However, to ensure that there is engagement across our communities, that's where we would like to be able to get support.
Inga mana, inga reora, rangatira mā, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Ngā mihi ngā whānau te moana nui a ki wā. Ngā mihi, Elizabeth, thank you very much for opening not only the conference, but also this particular session. I think that this whole notion of a rainbow strategy actually has been something that our cross-party group has been thinking about too, from our perspectives. What are our priorities? What is the legislative reform that we as politicians from across the House have identified and want to commit to? One of the issues that we have as a cross-party group is trying to find the things that we all agree on. because once we do that, then actually we can have a concerted effort. And I also want to acknowledge that Marama Fox is a former member of our group, and we also have a number of other members of Parliament. And the other issue that we've been grappling with is how do we hold the public system, the public service, accountable for meeting the needs of our communities and the diverse needs of our communities. So I also want to tautoko the development of a national rainbow strategy. And I think you've got the actors here. We've got the community, we've got the Human Rights Commission, and we have the cross-party rainbow group. And I think that together, if we start looking at what each of us is doing and looking at those points of intersection, what I hope is that actually we can have a strategy that's a collaboration between the community, and the community will lead some aspects of that. It is with the Human Rights Commission who will lead some aspects of that, and it's also with our cross-parliamentary group who will lead some aspects. But I think you're right. It's we need a process that ensures all of us are empowered, that nobody's disenfranchised, that everybody buys into and commits to. So some thoughts around how you think, or how, what's the next step really in getting us all together would be appreciated, because you know, you independently have taken some responsibility, as have us, but how really are we going to make this work?
So I have lots of brilliant ideas around this myself, and have talked to many people everywhere I've gone to and spoken to in the last nearly a year. I've brought this up to ask who's interested, who wants to be involved at some level. And so, off the top of my head, the very first thing we wanted to do was to convene a komatua council of sorts, is to grab the elders of our community across all of our different identities and just to create the values and confirm the values and get the mandate of how this work will be approached. The other two key things I would like to have done by the end of the year is a youth hui around this, so that we have really clear about our young people being engaged in this. And the third thing is a research symposium, so that we can start looking at, yes, we know a lot of our issues. They've been expressed in different ways within our community, if not out in the wider world. What evidence do we need to back some of that up? What things do we need to get done urgently? And from that, we'll be doing a national tour around the country so that people have the chance to speak, not just about identifying issues. I'm always about, yeah, and what are we going to do about it? And what? And what? And what? And so, and looking forward into the future, because nothing is simple. We have to do many layers of work to address these things. So those things will roll. I want to come back to just address what you said at the beginning, that this is something absolutely I saw, that it will be done in conjunction with government, in conjunction with Parliament, so that we get it when that is done, and as it progresses through, that we are all engaged with it and we are all committed to it. I don't see it as a separate, we're going to, as we often have done and as we have needed to do, is to say this is our thing, and then we go to you and we either do demands, grovelling, try to, you know, lobby, and all of those things. We see this as operating at a higher level, and that not to say any of those other things are not necessary in different contexts, but in this case, absolutely something that we can work together.
Hello, everybody. Look, first of all, thanks for the opportunity to be here today and to be able to listen to what you have to say and to ask questions. First thing I'd like to say is applaud the strategic approach that you are proposing. I think that is definitely the best way to go. And I hope you will identify the priorities in that as well, because there's going to be a lot to do, as you well know. I really only have one question at this stage, and it's around public engagement, because as you will know, politicians find things a lot easier if the public understand what's going on, and there needs to be some leadership in that, which I'm sure your groups can provide. So my question would be, what proposals do you have to engage the wider public and to try and bring as many people with us as possible?
That's a really good point, one of which not really considered very much. So now that I think about it now, I see the value of that. To begin with, the strategy is very much looking at what are the issues, much of which is known, the creative ways in which we see that these can be addressed. And I think you're right, depending on what the issues are, depending on which communities we're talking about, then we're talking about engaging the wider community. If I could give the example of the Intersex Roundtable that's coming up next month, where absolutely those issues are so key for intersex people, and then the roundtable creates an environment which can engage us as Tangata Whenua, it can engage medical profession, and other parts of the community. So I see that is quite a lovely model for engaging the people who have direct input into those particular things, in this case a particular health focus, but I can see that how that can operate. And the fact is all of us and all of our different organisations are engaging with the general public as members of whānau and hapū and iwi, as members of families throughout this country. We are constantly engaging. Bella gave the example of being an activist since she was 11, and those of us who have been activists our whole lives as well, this is something that we're involved in constantly. So I see that will be part of a natural process to begin with. We'll start looking at our solutions and then seeing, to achieve these things, who do we need to talk to? And it'll become part of that wider discussion in the public. But thank you, that's something I'll put more thought into. Kia ora.
Oh, well, kia ora, and I'd like to thank everybody, and particularly Jackie and the Commission and the organisers for having me here. Thank you very much. I have to say, I really admire the idea of thinking several steps ahead, because it's the easiest thing to say everyone should do and the hardest thing to actually do. So good on you. I just have one sort of slight challenge. It's all very well to have a national strategy, and I think we should, but we should also be mindful that many of the challenges that the communities that we are trying to advance have faced have been from state laws and state institutions. And I just wonder if you've got a strategy to make sure that a national strategy doesn't become, and I hesitate to use the word, but a national straitjacket.
I see that it's something that will evolve, and it's something that needs to be constantly updated, and that because at this stage, when I first started talking about this, people said to me, oh, you'll need an office and you'll have to set up get some staff. And I'm like, no, let's not constrain our thinking into particular solutions. There's different ways that this will be able to operate. I don't see that it's something that gets done, then it's done. It gets finished and that's the piece of paper to sit on the shelf, or it goes to wherever it's going to go. This must be a living document that will only happen if people who commit to it, the organisations that are already doing the work, and all the things we need to set up to do the rest of the work, only if they continue to be engaged in that. And that is absolutely a challenge of this work, is if people can see that long-term goal and see that this will feed into and help attain. And because the key thing about this as well is that so that we each become familiar with each other's issues.
Yes.
Because it's so easy when we're in our little worlds and to not see what's happening for the rest of us, or to resent people because they see that they've got more privilege than us or whatever, instead of seeing the whole picture. And I think we keep that a living document so long as we set it up right, the process is sound, the engagement is sound from the beginning, it will continue to be so.
Thank you, panel, and thank you very much, Elizabeth. And again, please give her a fabulous round of applause for going first. Thank you. People, we're going to move down our submitters list, and we'll hear from Sally Dello first, and then after that, Sandra Dixon. I just want to check and see if Kelly James or Sarah Urquhart have arrived in the room. No. So after... After Sandra, then we'll be going to Bella. And then we've got some an indication from some other people that they want to speak as well. So But if you want to, again, if you want to line up to give a brief oral submission to the panel, then you need to let Moana know so I know to pop you into the order. So, Sally Dallow, thank you very, very much.
Yay! Just had instructions from our sound people that if I could stand by the square and talk. So, Joey and Jack, can you come and join me over here, please? Makes it a bit easier. I put in three oral submissions to... I just have one opportunity to speak. The reason for doing that is we held our Trans Hui yesterday and the closing for the submissions to the panel was on Sunday. So in order to... I wanted a placeholder for the trans community to be able to speak to the panel. I want to cover off three areas. I'm going to try and do it very quickly, and I'm going to ask Jack Moon and Joey McDonald to add some extra words. I'll try and be brief. The three things that are important for me as a trans person, and I don't speak for the community, I'm speaking for myself, and from listening to people yesterday, adding gender identity into the Human Rights Act. There's a reason that it's important to us at the moment, because it's not in the Human Rights Act. We can't point to that and point corrections and police and justice to that act and say, hey, your gender identity is in the act, it's a human right, you've got to treat trans prisoners okay. We can't do that at the moment because all we've got is an opinion from the Crown Law Office. So that's kind of one of the reasons for looking at the Gender Recognition Act. The other thing I'd like to make with that is when they tried to add the words gender identity, I think this is your initiative, Louisa, to the annual bill that corrects typos and spelling mistakes. I had a conversation with some people from the Victoria University Feminist Law Society and working with Elizabeth McDonald and a couple of students. And they put together, they basically had a go at rewriting the act or the bits that needed to be changed. So there's conversations happening in the community and work being done. Hey, we've got voices. Please listen to us. Just a quick mention about health, and Joe's going to talk more about health in a minute. The Ministry of Health, through the High Cost Treatment Pool, funds essentially two trans surgeries a year. Now, I'm a scientist. I play with numbers. I went, what's the origin of those numbers? And surprisingly, they actually match the prevalence numbers in the DSM-4, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which for trans men was 1 in 100,000. The numbers work out, that's where they come from. My point is that the Ministry of Health made a commitment to fully fund trans surgeries based on those prevalence numbers. The problem is, based on the Youth 12 survey, there's not 160 trans people in New Zealand, there's 50,000. That's going to require a dedicated surgery theatre, double shifted, just to meet the ongoing need without covering the unmet need. There's a huge investment required to meet the health need, the surgical health needs of the trans, and it also includes the intersex community when they are of an age to make informed consent about what they want to do with their bodies. One more point and then I'll hand over to my colleagues. The Human Rights Commission, we're looking at trans prisoners. There's been a policy written, and there's just a phrase that comes, I believe, originated with disability activism. Hey, nothing about us without us. The trans community was not involved, as far as I'm aware, in writing that policy or having a conversation around that policy. The trans community has a range of skills and abilities. Like I said, I'm a scientist. We have lawyers in the community. We can have these conversations and have these conversations at a high level. Please invite us to the table because we have things we need to say. We would like to be listened to, not talked at. Mm. And the way the policy was written, only rich white trans women who can get gender changed on birth certificates can afford that, and those who most need help are often poor trans women of colour who are least likely to engage with the system to change their official documentation. The policy's been set up around the wrong way, so again, we would like to have that conversation because we've got some things to say.
Thank you, Sally. Thanks for this opportunity to speak. Kia ora koutou, my name's Joey McDonald. I'm just going to add a few extra points and some clarifications about the discussion regarding health and health services. In particular, I wanted to highlight that, as Jill has already said, Jack and Julie, so Jack Byrne and Julie Watson are already here, and their work has really underpinned all of us being here today. So I'm incredibly, personally, deeply grateful to you both. Thank you. Okay, you can cry. I'll try and take a few more minutes here. Our UPR submission, so I know this is something that you've had access to read, I think, the panel, that was the SOGI UPR submission that we completed a little while ago. That really does have some comprehensive recommendations about health, so I'm not going to just read them out or go through that again, because certainly I hope our community has access to that and we can make that available if you don't, and our panel already does. I'd just like to highlight two key points from that submission, and that was about intersex people and prohibiting genital surgeries and non-consensual medical interventions for intersex people. That is something we could have legislation about, that other countries have legislation about, that we need to be taking action on. And also a broader issue about understanding, as people have already said today, the overlaps and intersections between transgender and intersex communities, recognising that this is not the language that everybody would use anyway. It means that having access to high-quality health services, which is something like Sally has highlighted, the need for access to surgical support, which is something that some people want and other people don't want. A lot of people in my role, I can talk about a little bit what my role is, but it means that I'm seeing a lot of people who want access to mental health support, whether that's counselling or whatever. And often they don't meet that criteria for secondary mental health services. Our mental health services are set up very much around strict clinical criteria and a desperate kind of need. If you don't meet that criteria, you don't get access. So there's massive need in our communities that's really unmet by any public health system in terms of the discrimination and the minority stress that we face that causes us to develop all kinds of responses to that situation. We need our public mental health services to actually be able to respond to our needs. I love applause. I also wanted to clarify that hormones are something that a lot of people want access to, and in New Zealand at the moment, as you all know probably, it's really inconsistent as to the pathways of care or the ways that people might go about trying to access hormone treatment. So some people might go to a GP, some people might find a specialist, some people pay $7,000. There is no public health system that is set up to meet the needs of people who want access to hormone treatment, whether that might be an intersex person or a trans person or anybody falling under that diversity of sexes and genders. Working in mental health, I have seen that some people try and get that access through mental health services, and we're lucky that there are some great staff who will try and meet that need, but they're not funded to do that, they're not supported to do that, they're not given education to be able to do that, so not surprisingly, a lot of people are not picking up that kind of that need in mental health services. It's not something that a lot of people want to see housed in mental health services anyway, is another point. So access to mental health support and hormones are things that a lot of people talk about wanting. I want to emphasise the fact that transition means really different things for different people. So not everybody wants any kind of medical intervention. People who do want different kinds of things to suit the particular self-determination that we have. All of those services can be delivered on the basis of, we can talk about human rights, and particularly, I would say, respecting bodily autonomy and respecting self-determination. If we were able to have health services that were underpinned by those principles, a whole lot of people would be surviving and possibly thriving, but certainly not dying, which is what's happening now. I love Elizabeth's rainbow strategy, and I'm on board for contributing to that. And I also really want to point out that a lot of work has previously been done and has been presented to the government, and I rely on the HRC to keep reminding the government that we've been working our asses off to actually get that material to you, because a lot of us aren't paid to do that work. We don't have a lot of infrastructure, so I respect that a lot of people want to do the work without funding. As Elizabeth said, that's without that kind of restraint that funding can give you. But it means that we don't have the capacity to be constantly saying, please remember what we said last year, please remember what we said 5 years ago, please, 10 years ago this happened. We keep saying it, we keep saying it, we keep saying it, and it seems to fall on deaf ears a lot of the time. So please refer to the documents that already exist, as well as asking us for our current state of affairs and comments on that. Thank you.
My name's Jack Byrne. I'd also like to acknowledge and support everything that other people have said here. Joey didn't mention that they're one of the people who's been involved in the Auckland DHB, the Northern DHB proposals. And just one clarification. Currently, those discussions have not resulted in any improvement because they're just discussions at this point. And most trans people pay for every single aspect of our transition-related care in this country. The only thing that we could say for sure that we don't have to pay for is once we eventually get put on hormones, that it's covered by a subsidy, and it's one of the cheap, you know, it's cheap to be on hormones in this country.
Not always. Some people, there's some hormones that the doctor says that's the one you've got to
pay for. Yes. So even that isn't perfect. It's the same for the guys too. There's preferred models that aren't subsidised for some people as well. But everything else, most cases, if we need to get a diagnosis, we have to pay privately to get that diagnosis. Many parts of the country, we heard from people from Palmerston North yesterday, the endocrinology service there has said we will not accept any more referrals because they've got young people coming through NASI. So people are paying to see private endocrinologists. Most of us, there are many surgeries, trans men have chest surgery. We pay for that ourselves. There used to be a couple of doctors who did it, and then the DHB said, no, we're not funded to do that. So I know that the ministry often says it's great that the Northern DHBs are doing this, but we've been used as footballs between Ministry of Health and DHBs for a long time, where one says the DHB should be doing it, and when they're not doing it, they say that the ministry's not giving us enough money. So please try and find a way to sort it out, because particularly for young people, they seem, when you say pathway of care, it sounds like something, I don't know, clinical, or, but actually it's pathway to life. People don't see a pathway to life at all. I was actually talking about health. But my bit is about something really fundamental. I loved that when, I think it was Joy who came up with the title for To Be Who I Am, the language of the Transgender Inquiry Report, and I was very lucky to be working as a senior policy analyst at the Commission when we did that report. Now I work as a consultant in the region for organisations like the United Nations Development Programme, and so at the moment I'm working on a legal gender recognition project across Asia, 8 countries in Asia. And people often think, you know, legal gender recognition is just being able to change documents, but it's actually about really fundamental human rights. It's the third right mentioned in the Job Jakarta Principles. It's the right to recognition before the law and the right to equal protection before the law. It's a fundamental civil and political right, and that's why I chose to make a personal submission to the Human Rights Committee that is looking at New Zealand's periodic review in the next couple of weeks under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It's a really fundamental right. Most of you probably know that we've got a world-leading policy in New Zealand for changing passports, and that's huge. It has made a huge practical difference for people's lives. But not every person can change their passport. If you're a person living in New Zealand, but you're not a New Zealand citizen, you can't change your passport. And there are some circumstances where you still need your birth certificate. My understanding is that what's written on your child's birth certificate, the sex on that, depends on what's on your birth certificate. So if you still, what's on your birth certificate is what goes on your death certificate. And many trans people in this country have changed their passport, but many of us have incongruent documents. Our birth certificate says something completely different from what's on our passport. And I would have thought that was of concern to government. And we navigate what other people often think of us as deceiving people about who we are, or wonder about that we're trying to be fraudulent. We navigate that, knowing that our documents are incongruent. And they're incongruent because the process for changing a birth certificate is a family court process. And there's someone from, Karen said to me today, most of the girls, particularly Māori, you know, don't know that you can change a birth certificate without having surgeries. So there's huge issues around people's perception of the law. There has been a family court decision. It's only, they're all lower level. They don't set precedents, but there was a family court decision that said not all surgeries are needed in all cases. But it's still dependent on what an individual judge says. It still says in the Act that you need medical evidence. We can't even get to see an endocrinologist to get on hormones. The chances that we're going to get them to write a document for us that we can take to the family court gets remoter and remoter and remoter. When there weren't many of us, and, you know, it was relatively easy to do. Now we can't even get a script out of them. How are we going to get that letter, you know? And maybe the family court judge will think the GP's letter's enough. But there are people still being asked to show proof of sex reassignment surgery, even though that's not covered. Why can't we just make it simple? Adopt our passports policy. It's world leading. Use that for changing birth certificates as well. Give us equal protection under the law as every other citizen. Remove that discrepancy that there is between our documents. And do the wonderful thing that we do in this part of the world is recognise three options. M, F, or at the moment it's X as a third option. So it wouldn't cost you much. And also, totally support what you said. There are people here who have lots of expertise. Regionally, Fiji. They have sexual orientation, gender identity and gender expression recognised in their constitution. Australia have added intersex status as protected as a prohibited ground of discrimination. We can learn from each other, and there's a lot we can share with you, and would really like to finally see some progress. Kia ora tātou.
Thank you for that very impassioned presentation. I mean, it seems you're sort of fighting a three-front war for legal rights and recognition under the law, a welcoming education sector, and a proportionally funded health sector. And sometimes one of the best things to have is a working model. And just picking up on those final comments, I just wonder, perhaps in all of those categories, if I've got those right, or perhaps just in some of them, are there particular countries that we can look on as a model, or has the whole world got a long way to go?
Yeah, there's some really good countries, and you know, you might be surprised. The world leading one initially was Argentina on legal gender recognition, access to healthcare. Probably not a country that New Zealand looks to a lot. Now there's a whole lot in Europe, which is probably where you're more likely to look. Malta, wonderful legislation. Yeah. Not only does it have, and the people here from Ilga will know all this stuff too, not only does it recognise people's self-determined gender identity, it statutorily prohibits surgeries on intersex infants with children without their consent. We could look at our female genital mutilation laws, you know, that explicitly at the moment have an exception and say we don't agree with female genital mutilation, but we can have surgeries we allow as an exception for intersex children. It's a very simple place to start. So Malta does that. Their law change also has policies around how to improve things in schools, and they've instituted a review of health services. Another country we look at, the UK, they've had a Gender Recognition Act there, which is a medical model quite similar to ours, their birth certificate model, and their select committee in January this year said it needs to move to a self-determination model. Mm. And we've got Denmark, we've got Finland, we've got good provisions. So that's around the legal gender recognition. Transgender prisoners, there has been some good work happening in both England and Scotland. So because I'm a human rights researcher and I work in this region, I'm very happy to provide examples of any of these policies around the world. And one thing with the trans, we keep talking prisoners, we keep talking about where people are housed, but equally important is access to healthcare when trans people are in prison and access to rehabilitation. And currently those have become invisible to the debate.
I'm going to ask panellists and submitters to speed along a little bit. We're way over time, and I've let that run because I think the core of the issues that both Elizabeth and Sally's group have presented are some of the critical ones. But there are some other submitters to come, and we do have to finish at 11:30. So I'm just going to ask us to clip it along a little bit. But thank you.
Yep, I just wanted to respond to the idea of using models in terms of health.
Mm.
It's particularly important in New Zealand, and as Jack mentioned, I'm part of the Northern Region DHBs doing the kind of what they're calling the Trans Pathways of Care proposal, and we don't know yet where that's going to lead. But it's really important that we have culturally appropriate models of health here, and that needs to be recognised in relation to SOGI or gender identity or trans communities as much as anything else, so making sure that everything is appropriate when it comes to Māori and Pacific. And I think we can do that by relying on, instead of clinical criteria and a medical model and a DSM, we can look at informed consent models of access, which places are doing, some places are doing, instead of relying on pathologising language about meeting certain clinical criteria. There are models of care that are much more about respecting self-determination, respecting bodily autonomy, understanding that, you know, we are the experts on ourselves. We could make that happen here. We could be world leaders the same way that we are with our passport policy. It is really, really possible for our health services to move ahead of the game. Currently, we're way behind. We could actually fairly easily, I think, implement some education and some adjustment to our services to make them genuinely helpful and responsive in a way that won't go out of date in 3 years.
Thanks very much to the last three speakers. I've made some very valuable notes as a result of that, so you've had an effect already, at least as far as we're concerned. There's a tremendous amount there, and a lot of which is going to need a lot of thought. And there are many things I'd like to explore further, but for the purposes of just now, I'd like to focus on the ways in which birth certificates, passports, and other official documents can be changed. Obviously, the current law is a mess and needs attention. What I'd like to know from you is how you think a process for change of all such documents at once, rather than doing it piecemeal one at a time, might happen. Have you given any thought to that?
Yeah. And can I have one person from the submitting group to answer that question? Because I've got three more submitters.
Yeah.
And I've got a really short time. So this has been really valuable, and I need to wind it up.
Just to keep it very brief, the key document actually turns out to be the birth certificate. The way that the passports and driver's licences, they were all sort of piecemeal. If we have the birth certificate, everything else sorts it out. So it really stands on that birth certificate.
Cool. Thank you.
Really, they'll have to be short answers.
No, I basically wanted to commend you on your Coalition 2013 submission and actually just confirm something that Elizabeth said earlier, that actually this is a living document and it needs to be updated because, the whole commitment to changing or adding gender identity, for example, to the Human Rights Act, it seems that some people want to expand on that, not just make it gender identity, but gender expression or whatever it might be. And the commitment from both the Human Rights Commission and the submission is just to gender identity. So that's probably the biggest thing, other than to say everything that has been noted, we're working tirelessly away on our own document, which includes everything that you've highlighted. So I look forward to working with you, essentially.
Thank you.
I'll just pass it on. Yeah, very quickly, thank you for your submissions. Thank you for all the people that did take the time to write. And very powerful, a lot to take on board, and you can absolutely depend on the Human Rights Commission to keep the government honest, and we're here for the long haul, don't worry.
Echo the points that other panellists have made about the value and large number of points that you've made that I agree with and agree need to be incorporated into policy. One question reduced to a very brief answer version is, I'm the sponsor of Tommy Hamilton's petition to the Health Committee. When you spoke about health services, you largely spoke about access to services and pathways of care, pathways to life, if you like. But I really noted that when Tommy and Marnie came and spoke to the committee about the petition, that their focus was very much on quality of care. And not only about care specific to trans or intersex services, but actually to all health services. Do you agree that that's an important part of what the system needs to respond to?
Yes. We would like to have quality services. That's partly what I do, is trying to provide education to people working in Auckland District Health Board mental health and addiction services, so it's a tiny piece, really. And I'm trying to improve those services. But that said, a lot of our services that we're trying to get access to are not funded to meet our needs, and if they're not funded to meet our needs, then we can't improve their quality because they don't even exist in the first place. So we need to both be improving the services that do exist, recognising the great work that is happening, and actually making it official and giving people designated time, designated portfolios, designated processes to be able to meet our health needs. Otherwise, we're just improving the quality of things that don't even exist in the first place. So.
Thank you.
Very, very good. Sandra. Can I have Sandra Dixon? Given the timing, I'm going to have to be really go to strict timing on the remaining submissions. There'll be a 10-minute slot for Sandra, who provided a written submission. Then we've got Bella after that. I'm going to have to give you 5 rather than 10. And Eliana Rubashkin is here. Ah, right. You've got 5 minutes as well. Well, we got an email from you saying that you were, and you've submitted some stuff. But those are our speakers, and then I'm going to have to wrap up at 25 past 11. So, Sandra Dixon, please, give her a big hand.
Thank you. Kia ora, panel members, and so nice to be doing this with whānau.
Yeah.
So today I'm speaking on behalf of Arataiohi, which is the peak body for youth development in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We're an umbrella organisation with nearly 800 members from the youth sector. We include national organisations, clinicians, youth workers, schools, holiday programmes, the youth sector. And we were set up to support people who work with young people to be more connected, effective and accountable. So my submission today is going to focus on how we create safer environments for Rainbow young people, because the young people aren't the problem here, it's the environments that they're growing in. Arataiohi literally means pathway to and from young people. And I'm going to use rainbow, and I know it's a contested term, but I'm going to use rainbow for people under the sex, sexuality and gender diversity umbrellas. So back in 2012, the National Youth Sector Report, from a consultation with more than 250 people across 11 hui, recommended that rainbow issues be included in all facets of youth sector work. The youth sector recognised that rainbow young people struggle with discrimination, with stigma and with exclusion, which creates unique harms. And they also noted that there were really significant risks in under-resourcing the rainbow support sector, because that sector was relied on by the youth sector. These needs were echoed in a 2014 report from a national survey which called for rainbow competency training for the wider youth sector. Also in 2014, we began our Queer Trans Grants program to support groups working with rainbow young people around the country. Over 2 years, we engaged with 57 groups, 48 of which we funded, which I'm not sure if anyone else at that time knew there were 57 groups working with Rainbow Young People around the country, but we certainly didn't. You can see there, I think, a quite staggering response to our community scrambling to keep up with the needs of Rainbow Young People. Last year we held three forums and we surveyed these Rainbow support groups, the ones that we'd funded, and there were six pressing issues that were identified in these consultations. So the first one, number one, burnout is a serious issue for the Rainbow support sector. These groups are mostly being run by young Rainbow volunteers. They're dealing with really complex stuff. They're doing an extraordinary job, but they've got a lot on their plate. Number two, there are significant gaps for Māori and for Rainbow young people from diverse cultural backgrounds, which is a problem because of racism, both inside and outside the Rainbow community. Number three, suicide is a serious issue. We've got lots of stats on this. I think this one's particularly horrifying. Three quarters of our groups said that they are working with a Rainbow young person who's suicidal. Nearly half of them had worked with a young person who had later killed themselves. Homelessness is a serious issue. Half of the groups that answered our survey had had a staff member offer personal housing to a homeless young person because there was nowhere safe for them to go. Number five, there's no Ministry of Health level best practice guidelines for Rainbow young people, and therefore there's no accountability in healthcare environments, and we've heard a lot about that already, so I'll leave that one there. Number six, there's no Ministry of Education level best practice guidelines for Rainbow young people and no accountability in education environments. And what that means for our Rainbow support groups is that they are literally picking up the pieces from the interactions that our Rainbow young people have that they have no choice over. You have to go to school. You need healthcare. Aotearoa is continuing to support the youth sector working with Rainbow young people. We have some new Rainbow infographics which are based on nationally representative data from Youth 2000. I'm going to share copies with you today. And we're also working on a Rainbow competency framework for the youth sector based on local, national and international best practice. Developing Rainbow competency will help the youth sector create safer environments and address the discrimination, stigma and exclusion that create the horrible statistics that we've identified in all the research we have. It's all very consistent. But the reason I'm submitting today is that this work to create safer environments that we've been doing, that the youth sector's been doing, that the Rainbow support sector's been doing, isn't going to succeed without your support. We urge you, Aotearoa urges you, to encourage the introduction of Rainbow competency, not just in mainstream youth environments, but in government departments. We urge you to support the at least 57 Rainbow support groups around the country that are literally doing life-saving work and are literally, I can't say much more than that, actually. They're literally doing life-saving work with our treasured Rainbow young people. Thank you.
I'm done. I'm going to ask Larissa to start in the middle this time. And brief, a comment or, again, short answer questions are really good.
Yes, no. Well, firstly, thank you for the work that you do. It's incredibly valuable, and your submission is well made. What I wanted to highlight, and actually David and I are part of the cross-party youth parliament group, and one of the topics that will be discussed generically in the Education and Science Select Committee this youth parliament is, should schools be required to be more accessible to LGBTI communities, to specifically look at school culture and facilities. So this is an issue that obviously is generic. It's not just an issue that we need young Bella and Alex being a champion of, but I think that providing forums where actually this is a generic issue that all of us need to take responsibility for. Regarding the Rainbow Tick, I'm aware of the work that Michael Stevens is doing, obviously, and Corporate New Zealand have actually grabbed this concept, and particularly the banking sector. Yes. I don't know of any public entities that have put their hands up, but actually maybe Parliament should be, and our parliamentary service, Jan,
should be an entity that we encourage to go through the rainbow tick. So completely agree that, that that's a really good indication of how responsive organisations are to...
The Rights Commission is currently engaged with rainbow
tick. Oh, well, that's very good. I think I don't really have a question as such, other than I guess it's a everything you've said is a challenge to us. I'm not aware of those 57 groups. It'd be really good if you actually shared that information with us, because then our cross-party group can write probably letters to the Minister of Youth Development, and I don't know, we'll have a brainstorm about what other minister it's relevant to, but someone has to fund them. You've been funding them in the interim.
We've been funding them through NYD.
So she's aware of it. Yeah, I am aware that there is more money in the area and they've funded Rainbow Youth. But just thank you very much for what you're doing. Does anyone else have a question?
Yeah,
actually?
Can I just say one thing to that?
I want to say something about the importance of the small local group. Recently I was involved in a national road trip for another piece of work, rainbow related, and we had a hui in Whangarei that a young trans woman from Dargaville came across to attend, and she said she'd come to that because it was going to be her only chance to see people like her that month. So for her, she was saying, one of the things I need is stuff where I am. Yeah, it's a challenge.
I've just got a minute and a half left on this submission. Panellists might decide as to who's going to ask one more question and get one more answer.
Well, if nobody else wants to.
Sorry, Dennis is going to do that. Thank you, Dennis.
I'll ask a very specific question. In your view, what would be the top action priorities for government to prevent youth suicides?
In fact, we were the first organisation to chat to the person who's working on that at the moment, so that's fantastic. I think rainbow young people need to see themselves everywhere. I think we need to be visible in schools, we need to be visible in healthcare environments, and visibility doesn't mean a poster on the wall, it means that the processes and policies in those places respect us and treat us with dignity.
I think we need to move. Thank you very much, Sandra. That's superb stuff. Thank you. We've now got Bella Simpson, and I've got a 5-minute timer for the whole session, so this has to be really short. We've got one more speaker and then we need to wrap, and otherwise we'll be here until after lunch and someone else will miss out.
I think the first thing to mention, though, is that this is the third time this week I've been asked to keep it short. So it's just a consecutive thing of young people asking to keep things short. So we need to remember that young people have a voice, and I'm just going to talk. So.
Point taken, and I didn't have a written submission from you for this panel, and the priority's been given to those who did that. It's not about being a young person. Please talk. I'm not going to take up your time by fighting with you. I don't want to do that.
No, that's fine. Okay, so I am 19. When I was 11, I came out as a young trans woman, so I've been through primary, intermediate and high school as an out trans woman, tokenised and used to educate teachers and other staff members. So I've been through it all. I know what it's like. The statistics at the moment are that 1 in 5 young trans people are attempting suicide. These numbers are extremely high, and these young people are not feeling safe, they're not feeling supported, they're not feeling respected, and they're not feeling heard. There's a lack of education in health classes, and there's just a lack of education in general in schools. So in like English and stuff, you'll never learn about any queer issues or any queer pioneers. You'll always only ever hear about the cis heteronormative things. And so my question was, what are you guys doing about that? I do hear that Louisa and David, you guys are doing things, but at the same time, that's to a youth voice and expecting youth to give answers. So I don't really take that as a serious start, but it's a start. So, yeah.
Where should we start? Jackie.
I think I've been really quite overwhelmed by all the submissions and the comments to date, particularly everyone's submission, your submission as well. And I think, where do we start? I think, well, we've got to absolutely keep the government honest. And this is part of what the HRC is doing today, is facilitating officials who are here in the audience listening to the issues that you're raising. And it's clear that we need a whole-of-government approach, not just a siloed ministry by ministry. It's not, and we are currently doing that, it seems, with the family violence, the sexual violence. It's doable, and it needs the political will to do it. So, yeah.
Actually, I want to give this bit to Kevin, because he's been doing a lot of work in terms of Aero and holding our schools accountable to being responsive to the needs of our kids.
Well, Lewis. Thanks, Bella. So the project that Lewis is talking about started with something we did called How Do We Make It Better, which was a project that looked at taking on that idea of it gets better. How could you make it better right now? What are the things that we would do? And we identified the top priority as being improvement in schools. So while some schools actually were doing actually a fantastic job, there were also schools that were doing a really terrible job. How is that possible? You know, state-funded system. So what we did last time was another report that said, it was called How Safe Are Our Schools? And it was, some of you in the audience will have seen this report. It's an audit of Aero. It follows Aero around for a 6-month period and then asks in each of these schools how safe actually was the school. How well did it meet its requirement to provide a safe environment for all of its students? And in particular, we are interested in the trans, intersex, lesbian, gay and bisexual kids. What the report found was that while there were some great schools, something like 80% of schools did not provide a safe environment, and that was picked up by Aero in precisely none of the cases. So our priority is around making Aero accountable for checking in every school that it goes to, because that's the way that we can drive quality improvement.
Any other panellists that have something to ask or contribute to?
Well, I just wanted to highlight, I mean, there was an article in the paper over the weekend about Onslow College and Wellington High and their queer straight alliance groups, for want of a better word, actually writing to the boards of trustees and now having gender-neutral bathrooms. But what it seems to me is we're having a reactive system. So we actually have to rely on having the capacity within those schools, either from the teachers or the students, to then, you know, go through a process. What would be really good, and I just had this brainstorm, because I think the adolescent research group that Dr. Terri-Anne Clark is part of, and she came out quite strongly last year in terms of these statistics, it'd be really good if we did some modelling and told every school actually how many queer kids they have. Because, you know, that is a potential way forward, to say to every school, you have queer students as part of your student group cohort for this year. What are you doing to ensure their safety? I don't know if how crazy an idea it is, but I was just thinking we should engage with our researchers, with the evidence, to then hold. Because, the Out in the Fields report that came out last year about the homophobia in sport, I mean, we've got a whole lot of scientific evidence now. How do we use that to hold Rugby Union accountable, Sport New Zealand accountable, for example? And I think that's kind of the space that we're in, and the dissemination of that, I think, is part of the responsibility that we have.
I won't take any time except to say that I think it is important that Aero changes its policy, and as a cross-party group, we've committed to achieving that. I realise that that in itself will not change the world, but in politics you can't lose what you don't have, and that's one small thing that I think we're pretty committed to getting done this year as a cross-party group.
Thank you. I think we're out of time for the submission. Thank you for your forbearance, Bella. I appreciate that. You probably had a lot more to say. But thank you very much, and panellists, thank you for your keeping it short. Please give Bella a round of applause for her submission. The same rules will apply to Eliana Rubushkin, who is coming to the microphone. We've got a strict 5 minutes going on you as well, so please take it away.
Kia ora, everyone. I'm going to be very brief, and I'm going to focus on the refugees and the refugee issue. I think it's very important, since I haven't been spoken here. The intersex issue, that is something that affects my personally, as an intersex woman. I just want to focus that it needs to be clear for you guys to understand that one thing is sexual orientation, one other thing is gender identity, one other thing is gender expression, and other one is sexual characteristics. Because if you want to put all as a whole in the anti-discrimination bill and you don't include sexual characteristics, we intersex people will be out of this anti-discrimination bill. Okay? Because I know it's very hard to put and nouns behind, but there is intersex people that they are not transgender, that they are not, they don't have any particular sexual orientation, or they don't have any particular gender expression, so they just will be out of this, and we need also to be protected. Okay? Secondly, you know, like, I mean, healthcare issues, as they are so difficult for trans people, they are even more difficult for intersex people, when there is not even a single doctor in the entire country that is able to understand your condition. And then all the limitations that we have in this case is like, trans people, they are fighting for quality of care, and many intersex people, they are just fighting for having the right to see at least one doctor. You know, like, I mean, all these kind of things that we need to consider. And now that is what I'm here speaking, like here, that is focusing on the refugees. I'm a former refugee. I came to New Zealand almost 2-3 years ago as a refugee from China. I was in a refugee camp in China. And I think it's very important, and I want to encourage you guys, especially from the Green Party, to force or to create a policy in relation to the refugee quota, to force to specifically allocate a percentage for LGBTI refugees accepted into New Zealand. Because it's sad to see that when I came to New Zealand, I was the first ever transgender or gender diverse person accepted as a refugee. That was for me shocking, when we are easily the most vulnerable segments of any society. And I mean, right now, Syria is having such a very difficult time. I'm sure that a transgender person, intersex, gay, lesbian, within this conflict is 1,000 times more vulnerable to any sort of things. And we are not paying attention to those refugees. You know, we just pay attention to something else. We are fighting here for being, you know, for equality, for the right to be represented, protected, but we are ignoring those ones who are really having a terrible time. Because even when we are refugees and we are in a refugee camp, you cannot imagine what is to be a refugee within refugees, because that's what we are. We have to suffer the most disgusting treatment within a refugee camp, and many things that I will discuss later. But, you know, I just really want you guys to focus on that, and also assist refugees that are already resettled in New Zealand, especially LGBTI, to get their lives back. Because, for instance, I am stateless. As Jack was mentioning, that many people have problems. Like, I'm not a New Zealand citizen. I have New Zealand permanent residency. I lost my citizenship for all these stupid things, bureaucratic ignorance related to my gender identity. I'm here in New Zealand. This is the only place I can live and stay. And I don't have a passport. If I want to have a surgery, I need to first be a citizen, then to have a passport, then to travel to Thailand to have my sex correction surgery. And I don't think it's fair. It's not fair that I have to do such a thing, just first becoming a New Zealand citizen, so, and then to have the money, the funds, to then go to Thailand. You know, all these kind of limitations that many refugees face. And just lately, I saw that Louisa Wall was the one that was advocating for the marriage bill. And I got married here with my husband. Okay. It was really a beautiful moment to marry my husband, and just, it was shocking that when I marry my husband, people don't even know if it's considered a same-sex marriage. It's like, because, you know, I'm intersex, so how do you really, there's no way to identify this marriage as like a rainbow marriage. But they put my name my name of my birth certificate in my marriage certificate, and I'm ashamed to showing one of the most beautiful moments of my life. I'm afraid to share to everyone. I cannot share to the family of my husband or someone else my marriage certificate just because my name is there. So all these things, beautiful job you did, but look, all these blanks, you know, that create these kind of things where you are getting someone ashamed. Okay, thank you so much.
Just briefly, I'll keep my summing up very brief. But very briefly, is there any response to the issue of LGBTI refugees and any commitments, any questions?
I just wanted to say I have been working with a human rights advocate in Australia there are LGBTI people in Nauru. And actually, I had a talk to Jill about this earlier. I'm going to see Dame Susan, who I think has been really strident in advocating not only for increased refugee quota for New Zealand, but also that human rights issues should be part of the criteria for who we take. But I do want to say we don't specify who we take. I sat on the Foreign Affairs Committee last year, and there were quite a few Christian groups and a petition for us to take Christians specifically from Syria because of their persecution. But the New Zealand, our position is never to identify who we take, but we can take different groups based on the circumstances and through human rights considerations, which I support 100%.
Thank you. Unless there's something pressing, I'm going to say thank you so much to Eliana for her presentation, to the panellists for their response. Please give her a round of applause.
There you go.
And thank you. I'm going to do a very brief summing up. I'm going to cut that short because I had a pretty busy opening. So I'm not going to summarise the issues that have been raised. You've heard them all. These will be included in the report that goes to the conference organisers and will feed into ongoing work. What I will briefly reflect on is the process and some of the things that I've taken from the submitters about the process. One, and from the panellists actually, as Lewis has said, we have the access, we've got the community, the commission, the cross-parliamentary group, we should be able to do something with that alliance. We need to move forward together. Process from the communities, nothing about us without us. That's a critical element on the way forward. And please don't forget, and in fact, reference and give honour to the work that's already been done because it's still relevant. Okay, it's not just reports sitting on a shelf somewhere, and so when we bring up another issue, there's already work that's been done, and it's not just about legislation, but it's about how the rules are actually applied and what can we do to work together on that element of things as well. I'd like to thank you all for being here, taking part in this as the audience, but in particular I'd like to thank you who are the submitters that put a huge amount of effort into bringing the issues up before our panel. Thank you very much, submitters. It's very brave stuff to actually nail your colours to the mask and stand up in front of your peers and in front of a parliamentary group, so well done, thank you. And thank you very, very much to our panellists, David Seymour, Dennis O'Rourke, Lewis Wall, Dr. Jackie Blue and Kevin Haig. Please give them a wonderful round of applause.